Hi, everyone. It's your friendly neighborhood ex-Muslim, Abdullah Samir. I'm here with another episode and a really special guest. Today, I'm joined by Gail Jordan. Gail is a former Southern Baptist who left the faith 12 years ago, became a lawyer, ran for Senate as an open atheist. That's quite something. We're going to talk about that a bit. She's the executive director of Recovering from Religion. So that's how we became acquainted. I spoke to Eric Wells in a previous episode because when I found out about Recovering from Religion, I was amazed with the idea and the concept of having a support group for people that are no longer believers. If you're one of those people that need support, you used to be either Muslim or Christian or whatever it was, you've lost support from your community, you've lost support of your parents, or maybe it's not that bad. Maybe you still have the support of your family, but you just need someone else to talk to. You're looking for like-minded people. Recovering from Religion might just be that organization. As well, there's always ex-Muslims of North America, but of course you have to be limited. You have to be in North America to access their support services. Recovering from Religion, on the other hand, you can be anywhere in the world. You can join the Hangouts. And we will get to, Gail is going to talk about that a little bit more, how she's involved in that. But before we get started on that, I just want to talk to you personally about yourself. Sometimes people, you know, when they think of atheists, especially when they think of activists, they think of us as sort of one-dimensional characters. I always get asked myself, like, don't you have a life? Like, why are you doing this? Like, why do you talk about religion all the time? You're not a believer anymore. Like, let it go, move on with your life. But like, when I look at you, you're an attorney, you're a former personal trainer. You were telling me you did an Ironman. You have a blog, and you do farming as well. So let's start from there. Like, tell me a little bit more about yourself and, like, you know, where you're from, where you live and stuff like that.
Sure. Well, thank you again for having me, Abdul. I'm so happy to be here. My story is pretty routine in the beginning. I was born in the South. I grew up in the South. My parents are very religious, Southern Baptist, as you have mentioned, Christian. And I grew up in the faith. I didn't question it. I conformed. I made the attempt to follow the rules and be the best person. I married a religious man. I raised my children in church. We were the family that had our children at the church every time the doors were open. It was not the fundamental version of Christianity, but it was certainly the conservative version of it. And about the time I tell the story, I had four children quickly in a row. I had four children in 3 years. I threw doubles the last time. And so once I began to have children, I was so occupied. I loved parenting. I loved being a mom. And I'm a pretty joyful, sunny person. Even when I was a religious person, I was optimistic. And I loved life. And I brought those four children up, but I was consumed with taking care of them, as you can expect. And I brought them up on a farm. And farm work is, it's wonderful, but it's hard work. And so my days and my nights were consumed with my family, with my faith, with my home. And about the time the children began to be teenagers, they came to me with what I call typical teenager questions. They wanted to know, Mom, this boat and all the animals, and then the conflict about morality in the Bible. There's passages in the Bible where God spoke to his people and told them, you know, you go kill these people, but keep the women as your bounty. And and remember, there's even a verse about bashing the infants' heads on the rocks. Just do away with them because I've given you this. So they had the conflict about the morality. And then they had the problem, the science problem, how everything in the Bible, not everything, a lot in the Bible is contradictory to what we understand about how our physical world works. So all those questions led these four teenagers, and as I said, they were nearly all the same age. So they, and I was expecting those. I knew enough to know that, okay, when my children are teenagers, they'll probably push back a little. And I said to them, those are valid questions. Let's seek out the answers. So together we began to look for the answers. This is pre-internet days. So we went to the library and we researched. We went to our ministers. We went to our church staff, and we got what is baked into the religion as party line answers. There's responses to that. Religion has answers to those things, the boat and the morality. There's answers. They're not very satisfactory, and they're sometimes contradictory, but their answers. And it wasn't enough for these relentless children. And they were about, they were sort of starting high school at that time. They were being exposed to people of different faith once they got out of their small community school and they went to the bigger high school. So that was feeding into it. And we began together to research anthropology and geology and other sciences and other religion and philosophy. And we began one by one, almost in their birth order, but not necessarily quite in that order. They began to say, I'm not buying this. And they began to walk away from the faith. They were not vested in it so much. They had only, you know, they had gone to church and they knew all the Bible verses. But as they began to launch their young adult lives, and this was over a period of a couple of years, they rejected this. This was not sufficient for them. There was not sufficient evidence to live their lives based on these things. So they began to leave the faith one by one. They began to leave for college too, as they went through their high school years. This was a long gradual process, and I hung on the longest. I agreed with them. I struggled with it. I knew that my husband at the time was not interested in the journey, and I knew that my marriage would be at risk if I did the same thing. My family, my husband, my church could tolerate the children asking the questions because they're teenagers and there's a little bit of wiggle room there for acceptance for that, but not for an adult. So I hung on for longer than I probably should have. I had a dark time. I call it a dark time because I didn't believe it. And I kept teaching Sunday school. I kept trying to go through the motions of the faith. And finally I got to the point, the children were gone, where I just couldn't do it anymore. So I came out to my spouse. I came out to my community. I came out to my church. I said, I don't believe this anymore. And of course, everything that I thought might happen did happen. Mm. My community rejected me. My marriage didn't survive. And at 50 years old, 55 years old, I started over. Oh. And that's when I sort of pulled myself together. For some of us, as you know, Abdullah, everything changes. It's not just, okay, well, now I have Sunday mornings free. Mm. It's everything. It's how I want to live my life. It's what has value to me, what has meaning. What kind of a legacy do I want to live? How do I feel about my fellow human beings? Everything changed for me. And so I sort of reinvented my life. I went to law school. I began that career. I started my life again as a single person. So as you started this off by saying, sometimes people see us as one-dimensional. My former life was vastly different than my current life. I feel like I'm still the same person. I just came. I try to be gentle when I say, I try not to say I just ditched all that. I was stupid. Well, I try to be careful with it because I was a victim too. I was a victim of societal pressure, cultural pressure, religious pressure, as are people that still remain in the faith. And so I try to be patient and gentle and kind and understanding because I've been there too. But my life on this side is just awesome. It's I don't struggle with trying to make sense of the world. There's a lot we don't know, and the universe works in a random and chaotic way. And that's okay. Instead of trying to, I remember as a religious person, trying to determine what it was that I was supposed to do. What was God asking me to do? You know, we put a lot of emphasis on that as religious people, is this close relationship with Jesus and with God so that he can speak to you and guide your life. And I remember that was a burden. It was a burden trying to is this the right thing? Is this the right thing? And then you get into this mystical place where you're looking for some kind of sign. Your Bible falls open to a verse, or a person calls you on the phone and you're trying to find meaning in all that. And all of that went away. Life is random and chaotic, unpredictable, and absolutely glorious.
Yeah.
That may have been a little bit more than you wanted, but anyway, that's my deconversion story.
Oh,
that's
wow.
Coming away from religion.
That's a beautiful story. I found it interesting that when you have families that are actually more involved with the Bible, that's where you're able to sometimes find the cognitive dissonance and the questioning, like your children, when they heard about Noah's Ark. And it sounds like you guys had a deep connection with the Bible. Like you were reading the Bible, because a lot of Christians or Muslims, or anyways, and most believers, they don't have a connection with the holy books. They don't actually know what's in the book. So when you said, you know, when you gave some of those a little bit more disturbing stories, like, bashing the infant's head against the rock, or the Midianites and how the Israelites took them as, you know, kept the virgin women alive and all that. Like, I think many people are not aware of these things in the Bible in the first place. So, I mean, I think that's interesting in the first place, that the fact that you have a connection with the Bible is what started the world journey.
Absolutely. And I don't know if it's so much, I think back to my time as a believer, was it that I didn't know those passages were there, or did I simply shrug my shoulders and say, well, I don't understand why God would do that, but yeah, he's God, and therefore it's allowed, or he gets a pass or whatever. I don't know. People fall in any place on the spectrum of dealing with those troublesome verses, and every person's individual. But yes, a part of our research trying to figure this out was spending a lot of time reading the Bible and researching those passages and trying to put them in context and getting the history. And there is no context or history in which that's going to be moral or going to be acceptable.
Mm-hmm. And it's amazing how, you know, it's like the emperor with no clothes. Kids are able to point out the things that we adults, we become socialized to accept. And so when the kid says, hey, that's bad, hey, that doesn't make sense, we're like, what do I tell them now? How do I solve this conundrum?
How do I get out of this predicament? Yes, absolutely.
Yeah, and I also have 5 kids myself, so I understand. I understand where you're coming from with the, you know, being busy and all that. And it's amazing that you would actually, I mean, for whatever reason, you were inclined towards being open to reading, researching, and learning. And so there's, like you said, there's different ways that people deal with it. One way is to just shut down the questioning and just say, we just believe and this, we just accept it. And the other way is to actually research, to learn, to grow your knowledge. And that's what you did. I think that's beautiful. I wish more people would do that. You know, when the child has a question, or even, you know, you have a question, don't just accept what people tell you as an answer, but like, look into it for yourself, do your research, and learn, constantly keep learning, right? And for me as well, when I was, again, very unscientific as a believer, and I was gradually becoming more and more scientifically literate, to the point where finally I started to have cognitive dissonance, because the Quran and science, I could see a gap now. I could see this conflict. It wasn't a morality. I didn't even think about that for whatever reason. I just accepted it. But the science for me was a big thing. And then when I saw the Quran, it started to look more and more like a 7th century document. It didn't seem like it was written by God. And it was at that point when I said, I'm going to look into all of these things. And that's when I realized that there's just no way this is from God. And that's another interesting thing with your story, is that a lot of people who I talk to think that, like, Islam is unique in a sense that, you know, ex-Muslims, like, when what we go through is unique, but it's not true, because what you said, you could have been an ex-Muslim talking to me right now, like an ex-Mormon, an ex-Jehovah's Witness, an ex, you know, Southern Baptist, an ex-Muslim. We have a lot of similarities in our journeys, like what we went through, losing your spouse, and sometimes, you know, in your case, your kids are the ones who initiated it. But I've heard of cases where when the kids are a little bit older and the parent starts questioning, it becomes difficult for the kids because they don't know which direction to go. Like in my case, my kids are young and they were okay with it. They're like, yeah, dad, you're still the same dad. You haven't changed. You're still the same person. You just don't do those things anymore that you used to do, like praying 5 times a day and whatever. But my personality is the same, right? Before Islam and after Islam, I'm just able to express it because, you know, as a Muslim, I had to say that homosexuality is wrong, for example. So I'm like, yeah, I don't understand why God would do that, because I never saw it as a choice. I always understood that sexuality is just sexuality. You don't choose to be straight. You just don't choose to be gay. You are whatever you are, for whatever reason it is, whether it's genetic or upbringing or combination of factors, whatever, for whatever reason, that is what you are. So I always used to wonder, like, why is it considered sinful, and why would God not like that, when, like, that's just the way these people are? And so I had to say that. I towed the piety line. I'm like, yeah, well, we don't have to agree it's moral. That's what I used to say. Like, as a Muslim, I don't agree it's moral, but they can do whatever they want. It's up to them. But now I'm just able to say, well, there's no reason to say that whatsoever, because it's just, you know?
Right. And do you think that other believers, and as I said, everyone is unique, do you think that they armor themselves against these questions? Because there's a sensation that if you pull the string, if you begin to pull the thread and you begin to pursue the answers to those questions, it's going to a scary place right away. I think some people do that. I think they just simply think they, whether it's their own question or whether it's their children or whether it's their spouse or brother or sister, when those doubts and that word of doubt comes up, I think they build a brick wall, because it's a, you know, that expression, it's a slippery slope. If you start to question this, if you start to question sexuality, then maybe you question this other thing and this other thing. And I think enough of us are out, and atheists are visible enough that people see, and that's one of my goals for living as an out atheist. I want people to see I'm not perfect, but I live a happy, healthy life. And I think that more now than before, they see that. They see if you start asking the questions, you're going to go there. Now, you and I both know it's better on this side, but you don't know it when you're on that side. It's terrifying. One of the things that we do, and I know we're not talking about recovering from religion yet, but one of the things we try to do is anticipate in the deconversion process. And I don't know if you experience this. You have a loss before you have a gain. In other words, you're learning and you're excited, and it's like maybe this really isn't true, and that's exciting. But you're having a simultaneous loss because there is so much security in religion. You don't have to deal with difficult things. You don't have to deal with difficult things like sexuality. Sexuality is complicated and messy. You don't have to deal with it because it's black and white in religion. Yeah. You don't have to deal with any of those things that are so troubling because religion takes care of that. You lose this parent, this eternal parent that you think loves you more than anybody. That's a loss. No matter, now I'm happy. Now I'm happy that I don't have this eternal parent watching everything I do and judging me. But at the time, it's not what it feels like. It feels like you're losing this beloved parent. So I think it's important for us to recognize and to encourage people as they ask their questions. You do have a loss associated with the gain of living an evidence-based, reason and logic-based life. There are some losses that go along with it, not the least of which is the community. That's obviously a loss. But the psychology of losing the parent, losing the security of not having to struggle with difficult issues, definitely are a loss that you have to grieve.
Absolutely. I mean, that's really well said. Certainty is something we all crave. We all want the answers to be, you know, clear as day. And that is what religion provides for us. It provides a naive, even though it's a naive, very sort of ancient way of looking at the world, it gives you certainty. It's just like, this is just the way it is. The problem is, you know, it doesn't jive with reality. Now you have to figure out, how do I deal with this? Like evolution, for example, there's so much evidence for evolution, but you know, the Quran and the Bible, neither one of them indicate that there's any sort of truth to evolution. It's like God made Adam and Eve. And in the Quran says he made Adam out of clay. I don't know if it says that in the Bible. Okay. Same thing. So yeah. Mm-hmm. So you have, you know, God made the first man out of clay, and then through some process of incest or something, his children, they just reproduced, and now we have all of humanity. But like, it's a very nice, like, if you think about what, if you asked a kid, like, you have a mom and dad, and it's like, yeah. So they would think, well, there must have been a first mom and dad. Like, it just makes sense, right? Like, how else would we come? Nobody would have guessed that we evolved from previous life forms. It's just not something you would instinctively, it's not obvious, right?
It's not
just
instinctive. Like, that's a good way to say it. It's not instinctive. Once you have the scientific knowledge, it's gorgeous. It's absolutely beautiful. And you can see it over and over again. And when you embrace the concept of evolution, yes, it's a glorious thing. But I think it's important that you said it's not instinctive to know that, because it's scientific.
Yeah.
Instinctively you go, okay, well, all right, there's the first man, there's the first person. And then we came from there. there.
Yeah. And even like, even if you look at the Bible and the Quran, both, they talk about the firmament, like as if it's like a physical barrier, like the sky is solid. And when I was a kid, I used to look up at the sky and I used to think it's like we're inside a giant marble. Because it kind of curves, it looks like we're inside a ball, right? And that's kind of the impression you get when you read these holy books. It's again, it's a very early human attempt at trying to codify what they believe to be true. So they believe
what they could, and what they could see, what they could feel, what they could sense. That's and if that were the case, then they did exactly, you know, they tried to describe the sky and the stars and the moon, and they did a great job with that. It's just that's visually what we see in the beginning. It's just so much bigger than that.
Yeah. And so when we talk about how people like deal with these problems, so there are ways to deal with it, of course. So some believers will say, well, no, don't take the book literally. And they'll say, some would say that the evolution is there, it's hinted at, you know, the science is there. Like, you know, one famous person who does this is Dr. Hugh Ross, where he tries to read like actual science into the 7-day creation in the Bible. And it's like you really have to stretch. And you know, these people get actually backlash from other believers too, because other believers are like, that's not what the book is saying. Like, what are you saying? That's not like the Quran. I usually go to Quran, but like, yeah, the Bible or the Quran, it's not at all. I mean, actually the Quran doesn't have this same issue that the Bible has with the age of the universe, because it doesn't indicate, there's no lineage that goes back to Adam in any way, and any sort of, it's just more vague. So Muslims don't tend to be young earth creationists.
Okay.
They do tend to be like, again, a very small minority of Muslims who are flat earthers. Wow. Because the Quran does imply that he spread out the earth and he made it a bed. It says he made it like a bed. But of course, modern Muslims, the majority of them, they don't interpret it as actual like flat. They say, well, it looks like he spread it out. Doesn't mean, like, I don't know how you spread out a globe. But yeah, they say he spread it out. I don't know. Like they have ways. Even me as a Muslim, I wasn't a flat earther. Again, the small minority. But the ones who are hyper literal, they're stuck with that because that's like how it says it, right?
Well, you either, your option is either to be, as your expression, hyper literal, or if you're going to say, well, you don't take Genesis literally. That's a story. It's a narrative, whatever. But then other parts of the Bible, oh no, you take that literally. Okay. And who's in charge of telling us what to take literally? And what? And so then the person, now you're stuck with, I got to follow a person, or I have to do so much research and work to decide this is literal, this is figurative, this is a story, this is real. And so that's why there's so much. And that's why we have why religions are so fractured. Because there are those religions who do take it all literally. There are those religions who follow a leader who tells them this is literal and this is figurative. So, yeah, it's a mess. It's a mess. You can't land in a happy place that's consistently, you're just not able to embrace the book because you don't know how to deal with it. And I remember those struggles. I remember those struggles of trying to figure that out.
And it's not just that, but also the fact that it contradicts itself like all over the place. So which is why, again, you'd have different sects with Islam. You have Sunni and Shia, because even the history of, you know, the Prophet's history, we don't know for sure exactly the way things went down. Uh-huh. And there was a schism. Some people said, well, no, he wanted this person to be in charge. And the other guy said, no, this other person. So they ended up having two religious sects that to this day, they still exist based on the fact that it was never made clear before Muhammad died, like how things should have gone. So, and of course, both sides will say, no, it was clear. It was clear. It was our way, right? Like, we are the right sect. We are the chosen sect. You are misguided.
You're the ones who are wrong. Oh, it's just a recipe for, it's a recipe for fracture, because there's just, it's just, that's the nature of the books.
So you're in the deep south, as they call it, right? And so like leaving religion behind, like you were saying, is actually quite difficult. What are some of the stories you've heard from others that who've left, who become atheist, or people that they are atheists but they can't come out? Do you hear stories like that?
In the deep south, even in my in the years since I have been deconverted, it feels like things have changed because of the internet. Young people are just even here in the South, where we don't, let me say this carefully, we don't value education as highly as we probably should collectively in the South. So I think it's, I'm not saying it's getting easier. I think I'm saying it's getting more accessible to ask the questions, have the doubts, find someone with whom you can speak. When I came out, and this was just 15 years ago, when I was making my journey, my deconversion journey, I didn't know another non-believer, did not know of one in my small rural southern town. And of course, everybody I knew, if they didn't go to my church, they went to some church. I don't think people can claim that hardly. Now, maybe in the most rural of places, they may say that. But right. When we do things, and we'll, once again, I'm getting ahead of ourselves, but when you become visible, when you run for office, when you're a visible person, you take away that excuse that people don't have anybody to reach out to or talk to or look to or have an example or use as a role model or any of those things, because it's not true anymore, because there's so many of us and our voices are growing and we're growing exponentially. But here in the South, the fracture within families is tremendous. The loss of community, because you simply cannot reject the belief without a cost. You can't be going to church one day with all these people who, and I believe they genuinely love you, I believe you genuinely love them, then you come out and say, I don't share this belief with you anymore, and the relationships are over. There's, were they real to begin with? Yes, but yes, they were real relationships. Yes, people cared about one another, but you were rowing the boat in the same direction, so to speak. You had a common shared goal, and that was the foundation and the basis of your friendships. Mm-hmm. So yeah. Those friendships go away, and not very many friendships are based, when you are a religious person, based without that foundation. So when that foundation goes away and the relationships collapse, and you experience a tremendous loss of community, there are folks who go back to it just because they can't take the loneliness and it takes a while to build a free thinking community, to build a community of brand new friends, brand new support systems. It takes a long time, and not everybody can sustain the time it takes to be able to do that. It's better. I think it's better than it used to be, but it's still an arduous thing to rebuild and replace a community. And to deal with those fractured relationships.
Yeah. So maybe we can get into that. What is recovering from religion doing, and why are you so motivated, and why is this important to you to do this work?
This is always my favorite part of the interview. Recovering from Religion is a global nonprofit. Yeah. We were started about 11 years ago by Dr. Daryl Ray, who had an idea.
Yeah.
Sorry, animal drama. Who started with the idea, he knew that there needed to be some kind of place, whether it was virtual or real, where people could deal with the doubts and the problems that are associated with doubts. And he founded Recovering from Religion, and that's the beginning. Mm-hmm. Where we are now, everything that we do at Recovering from Religion, we seek to help folks who are struggling with issues of doubt and non-belief, whether that's the fractured communities, whether that's the psychological loss, whether that's examining one's sexuality, whether all of the things that are associated with the doubt from anywhere on the spectrum. We have a 24-hour telephone hotline with trained peer support agents standing by to take the call so that you can ask your questions. We have a 24-hour internet chat, same premise, peer support agents standing by. We are not a deconversion process. When people call into us with questions, the 6,000-year-old earth, I'm just wondering about that. It doesn't fit with what I'm learning in science, whatever. That's interesting. Tell me more about what you think about that. It's to ask reflective questions, to draw them out, to get them to identify what they're struggling with, to provide resources. We have an extensive resources database, which we open to the public. It's on the very first page of recoveringfromreligion.org, so that folks can listen to a podcast similar to this, read a book, visit a website, read an essay, join a group. We have local support groups in, we're not meeting right now because of the virus, but we have local support groups in 40 plus groups all across the country where people come together and meet once a month and talk about it and work through it and discard the junk and keep the good stuff and work through it and support one another. We have an online community where you can talk to fellow travelers, someone who's our agents, our trained peer support agents may not share the same experience as you. Maybe you're from the Muslim world. Maybe you're from the Christian world, wherever it is. In our online community, you can join a group and talk to fellow travelers who may be a little farther behind, a little farther ahead, and get support from there. We're a 100% volunteer organization. Most of us are motivated by our compassion for what this feels like, for what this journey feels like. Not all. There are some folks that who share our passion for helping people who've never had this religious experience, and that's wonderful that they bring that point of view in, and they are a big part of our organization as well. We have, as you can guess, scores of volunteers, trained volunteers who do this. As I said, because we have, because we're global and because the internet's available everywhere, we have a 24 hour internet chat in every time we've got, not only do we have clients reach out to us from every time zone, but we have volunteers in every time zone trying to fill the gap, to be there, to be a safe place to ask your questions and express your doubts and maybe get some resources to deal with all the fallout that accompanies doubting one's religion.
Oh, wow. And would you say that you're motivated to work on this because of the experiences you had in your life in Tennessee?
Clearly. When I came out or when I went through my deconversion process, my children were the only non-believers I knew. And then they left me. They grew up and they left me. And I was so, as I said, this was on the cusp of internet. And so once I got there and the internet was beginning to form, I was able to find a very, very few resources. They were not, now they're scads. You Google atheist organizations, atheist community groups, whatever, there's bunches of them. But back in the day, that would have meant so much to be, and to be able to join an online community of folks who chatted about it, talked it through, would have been invaluable to me. And that's a story that a lot of our volunteers share. It's a story that our volunteers share, that's what motivates them to do this. So yes, I completely say that. And not only that, not only is it why I do what I do, but that drives what we do in developing our programs. It drives us to say, sorry, kitty's jumping on the desk. What additionally can we do to help? What resource could we provide? In fact, it led us last year in 2019 to create and implement a weekend religion recovery retreat, just like the old school church retreats, only it was about meeting fellow doubters. It was about exploring and celebrating what life is like without this belief in a deity. It was about forming friendships with people who also live a life based on reason and logic. So all of our programs are about continuing to fill in the gap and be the help that people need when they're going through this very not easy time in their lives.
Oh, that's a cute cat you have.
A very cute kitten. And I have several of them, but this is a very cute kitten. Yeah. They want to climb all over my desk when I'm working.
They love jumping on the keyboard, and oh my God.
I know. That's always the challenge, isn't it? Keeping them off the keyboard.
Yeah. Do pastors still teach that the inerrancy of the Bible? Like, is that still something that's being taught to this day?
Yes, and I think even in the more progressive churches, it's hard to take a position outside of the inerrancy of the Bible, because what you're having to say is the exact same thing we just discussed. Yeah. This part's inaccurate, but this part is accurate. So I think I think especially here in a religious area in the South, I think even the most moderate of Christian churches would say the Bible is inerrant. There's some subtitles like The Bible's inerrant. It was written by imperfect people in the day, something, something, something. So they try to sort of modify what they're saying. But essentially, it's the same statement, which is the Bible is inerrant. We have a limited understanding of it, but the Bible itself is inerrant. Yes.
Okay. Yeah, you definitely, with Islam, it's just like everybody says that the Quran, they don't use that word inerrant, but it's like, it's the literal speech of God. So
literal, infallible, inerrant. Yes.
Yes. And so I want to actually, before we finish, I do want to talk about your experiences running for Senate and how that went as an open atheist, because I would have always thought if someone was going to be running for office, they would hide the atheist. They would like, like delete the blog, you know, like right. If you had a blog, you delete it. You go to your Facebook, put everything as friends only. Like, I've had to do that, and I'm not running for office. I work in software development. This is not my full-time job. I mean, I do this for fun and for, you know, to help make the world a better place, and because it's my passion, but like, I actually have a job as well. So my job is, you know, in the software industry. So I try to keep those two things.
Those two universes separate. I understand that. And I don't judge anybody for doing that. It's important to highlight that, because it's important that that's the status of what it's like to live in a religious area. It's important for people to know that there are those of us who can't be out, that can't be, you know, we should, this, especially in the United States, this is a country with freedom of religion. We should be able to do that. And we're not, because of the risk to our incomes, to our revenue, to our families, you know, to our community standing, all those things. My situation about running for office, it was for state Senate. When I became a non-believer, when I rejected the faith of my childhood, I had no room to be sort of halfway. It was because once I came out, I was out. I thought, I'm going to take the pushback. I'm going to take the blowback. It doesn't even matter what it is. I don't have the ability. I tried it. I tried faking it. I tried hiding it. I tried being in church. And so because I had that year plus experience, there was no question that I just couldn't do it. Because of that, I just decided, I came out to my parents. It was horrible. It was awful. I came out to the rest of my family. I came out to my community. Number one, because my personality did not lend itself to being able to hide all that. And number two, it had such an impact on me, this new worldview, this ability to live my life based on reason and science. I was proud of it. Not only was I proud of it, I wanted other people to feel the freedom that I felt. All of those things factored into me being open, out, visible, vocal. So I did that for years. I became part of and supported and built a free thinking community in my small town, which has grown. And now it's a thriving, busy community. I was one of the first ones. I literally made the meetup site in the beginning because in a practical sense, I thought, well, I lost all my church people. Now I have to rebuild my community. All those things were reasonable and logical to me. I had the confidence. I knew that my children loved and supported me. So that was the most important thing to me. And because I had that, I thought, I'm going to take the blowback of anybody else. So I did that. And I built myself into this position. When the time came to run for office, my humanism informs me. It informs my behavior. It informs me on how I treat my fellow human being. It informs my values. It informs my morality. And Tennessee is in the grip of and I know we have to be careful about politics here and understand that Recovering from Religion is a nonprofit. And these views are my own, my personal Gail Jordan views, not necessarily those of Recovering from Religion. My community, my state has what's called a Republican supermajority. In other words, all of the committee meetings, all of the votes can happen regardless of whether Democrats are in the room. It is a highly religious, highly Republican area. We didn't expand Medicaid with the Affordable Care Act. We have our rural hospitals are closing. We have some issues. We have some issues that are associated with Republican governance. Mm. When this seat became available, the Republican who had this state Senate seat hadn't even had a Democratic opponent in years. He'd had multiple terms without even a challenge.
Yeah.
He was a likable person. On the face of him, he was he seemed like a friendly, kind person, but his votes revealed that he didn't value education, he didn't value healthcare, he didn't, you know. So I thought, okay. And I mentioned a few minutes ago, I have the two things that make it easy to run for office. I have a big mouth and I have a thick skin. And I thought, you know what? I'm gonna do this. Sure, yeah. I'll do this. Yeah. I felt the pain of my fellow citizens who needed health care. I felt the pain of my fellow citizens who needed living wages.
Sorry, you just cut out for a second. Can you repeat that again?
I can. Tennessee prides itself with its Republican leadership on calling itself the destination state for low wage workers.
Right?
And they're proud of it. This is a thing that, this is so great. We needed some change. And I thought, it's, you know, I can speak up. I can speak out. Well, then you have to factor in this atheist problem, So the first thing, you know, I was interested in running. I'm interested in politics. I'm interested in governing. I'm interested in legislation. I'm interested in policy. So that all worked together for me to say, I think I want to run for this position. The first thing I did, it was a 5-county region, is, as I said, it was a state Senate, role. And so I gathered together the leaders of the local parties to say, okay, I want to do this and I'm ready and I'm willing. I have the time, I have the inclination, and I have the energy to run, but you need to know this little piece about me. And I have a strike against me. That's going to be a problem here in the, you know, the rural South, in the religious South. And one of them said, are you an abortion doctor? So I said, not quite. I guess that's the worst thing they could think of.
Yeah.
I said, no, but I am an atheist. I'm a self-identified atheist. And Abdullah, there was no possibility that I could have blanked that out of my head. I am so visible and everywhere on the internet.
Yeah.
And with my role with Recovering from Religion, there was no way. So I thought, I had made the decision. And so I gathered these people together to say, if you're going, I need your support. I need you leaders of the party to support me. And if this is not a thing that you can wrap your head around and embrace and help promote, because I'm going to need your help in your counties, let me know right now, because I'll step back and just not do it. If you think it's a waste of time and money, no. And they wanted me to do it. Now, most of these people are Christian people. Most of these people are progressive Christian people. So there was no chance of hiding from it, but I had made the decision. All right, I'm not going to hide from it. I'm not going to try to erase it. I'm not going to turn off my blog and hide my role at Recovering from Religion. But I'm not going to run on it either. I'm not going to put it on my billboards. It is integral to who I am, and it does inform my viewpoint. But this is the United States of America. And we have freedom of religion here. And so I thought, I'm just going to leave it neutral. I'm not going to hide from it. And they're going to find it out, whatever. The first time I ran in 2016, the opposing party, this, as I said, it was this gentleman who'd had the position for a long time. They didn't give me any attention at all. And he won handily, like they do in Tennessee. I got 35% of the vote or whatever it was. The second time this fellow took a position in the Trump administration, and the seat became what's known in politics as an open seat. In other words, both parties were going to be coming in with a new candidate. Well, I had the infrastructure I had run the first time in 2016. Mm-hmm. And then in 2018, I had the infrastructure in place. I had the staff, I had the volunteers, I had the experience. All of the pieces were in place. And I thought, I'm gonna do it again, because this time, this was after 2016, when the world kind of politically turned upside down. Yeah. And I thought, I'm going to do this again. Well, this time we did better. I have a whole talk about what it was like running for office. We did better because 2016 had happened, and it was an opportunity for people who weren't this hard right line. It was a breath of fresh air. It wasn't.
What happened in 2016? Sorry,
I lost the election, the national election that got everybody thinking more about politics. In other words, people who were sort of
when Trump was elected, basically.
Yes, when Trump was elected, and it got people going, oh, I guess politics matter. And so people and those of us on our side were so dismayed and distressed by what we saw happening at the national level, but also at all the way down to the state level, because of the support for what was happening, for the support for Trump. And I thought, this would be a good time to try to catch this open seat, mm-hmm. an open seat, an open election. You're the only election on the ballot. And so the problem in an open election, and you have a very condensed election cycle, a campaign mm-hmm. cycle. And so we thought, with those things in our favor, we thought we have a greater opportunity to win this seat. We had had Tennessee had shown some cracks in the wall, so to speak, in some special elections leading up to that. Anyway, all those things, we thought, yes, we can do this. And so we got to work, and we couldn't afford polling, but get this insider information, and we knew we were doing well. And because of that, then I think it led my opponent and his campaign staff to get desperate. And I think they did things that they normally wouldn't have done, which is they went full on after the atheism. They went on an attack for my religious freedom. They sent flyers, expensive flyers. The other party has a whole lot more money. There you go. A whole lot more money than we do. And so they sent flyer after flyer of, you know, distorted pictures of my face and telling me that just saying she wants to destroy the American way of life. it was just one after another. Yeah. The campaign manager of the other party even sent a letter to the churches, pastors, dear pastors, to let them know, and it said literally in the letter, tell your congregation to go vote for. Yes, this is the lieutenant. This particular tweet is the lieutenant governor of the state of Tennessee, which is, you know, the second in line for the governor, who said in the 40 years of all of his 40 years of politics, he's never seen a candidate as dangerous as me. And so I proudly claim I'm the most dangerous woman in all of Tennessee. So their behavior was reprehensible. It was unconstitutional. Yeah. It was unethical, and it was very, very effective. When they sent the letter to the churches, that's when our support, as much as we had good support, his people, the message to the pastors was one of fear and anger, and these atheists are going to take over the world, and here they come, and she's a baby eating, goat worshiping atheist. And it got those. And the sad thing is, Abdullah, it got the base, as they say in politics, motivated, this, which are poorer, older, whiter residents, just terrified them when they went to church and their pastor from the pulpit, which is highly unethical and unconstitutional, preached, go vote against this woman. She's an atheist and she's going to, you know, whatever it was that they fill in the blank of horrible things I was going to do, healthcare and education, that kind of thing.
And dealing with the opioid crisis, right?
Have a terrible opioid crisis. And one of my, I ran on a pro-cannabis campaign because we did, and my opponent was a very wealthy pharmacist. But it was effective. He scared this demographic. He got them out. He got their vote, and we lost that election. It was heartbreaking. And that's the way that's what they had to resort to win it, because up until the point that they attacked my religious choices and my religious freedom and my lack of religious belief, we were leading. So
sorry, I got disconnected for a second. Can you hear me?
Yes, I can. I can. Can you hear me? We had a thunderstorm here in Tennessee. I was afraid I was going to lose connection, but so far it's been
God has smiled upon us today.
That's what it is. That is right. God has smiled on us.
Sorry, I missed a second of what you said. When I heard your speech and I watched one of your videos before doing the interview, I was very impressed with you. I was like, what you did, what you stood up for, the fact that you ran on values. You know, like, these guys were running on tribalism, basically religious tribalism. They were saying, like, you know, they went back to us versus them, atheists versus Christian. Whereas you were like, these are the things I want to bring. And you ran a very vanilla campaign, like, you know, Medicare and, you know, like, increasing the wages and, like, you know, like a standard platform, right? But at the end of the day, you know, they wanted to get into mudslinging, tribalism, and like, let's be honest, like, you know, when was it Karl Marx said religion is the opium of the
masses? Opium of the masses.
Mm-hmm. I mean, he's right, right? I mean, we've evolved to have this sort of sheep-like thinking, and most people on Earth are religious. When Emperor Constantine, you know, chose Christianity as the state religion, he was able to unite everybody on monotheism, and it made him that much more powerful. When when King Saud wasn't a king yet, and he used Wahhabism, a form of Islam, hardline form of Islam, to convince all of these people, like, he made an unholy alliance with the religious right. He had this sheikh, Muhammad ibn Abdul Wahhab, that's where the name Wahhabi comes from, and he told him, you get these guys to fight jihad for me. He called it jihad, because of course, if it's jihad, then it's a religious fight. We're going to take over this place, and I'll make you the official, like, you know, imam or whatever, right? So that's what happened. They conquered that place. It became Saudi Arabia. I mean, that's religion has a lot of power like that. When it comes to controlling the masses, it does have that effect. It has the effect of influencing people. And especially, you know, when it comes to Islam, you know, they claim that Islam eliminated racism, but the problem is it eliminated racism and it replaced it with like a super racism, like a tribal,
super
like,
racism. That's great. That's a great description.
It's like a faith-based tribalism where now you see infidels or disbelievers as the other. And it's not even a problem. The problem is when you treat them differently based on, like, obviously I'm not black, I'm brown, and you're white. That's fine. I don't, like, we're all different, but as long as I treat you like, you know, based on the same values I expect myself to be treated on, then there's no problem with us being different, right? Right. And it's an irrelevant difference, really, the skin color. And religion should be another thing that's irrelevant. It should be a personal belief. You know, if you're a different religion or you have no religion, that should be just fine, right? So, like I was saying, I was very impressed with what you said when you said that, you know, what guides you is your humanism. There's two things you said. You said increasing joy and decreasing suffering are the two principles that guide you as a humanist. I just thought that was so beautiful. That should be what motivates all of us. Right?
And it's so simple. And I know there's some nuance to that, but I think generally that is the basis of humanism, is if we can make lives better by an action that we take or an action that we don't take, I think that's our responsibility as human beings. I think that, most religions have some version of this concept, that to whom much is given, much is expected. And I know that's kind of biblical, and I'm not sure if the Quran has that verse in it, but I knew that. I knew my privilege. I knew that I had lived in a country where I have the right to do all those things. And I thought, because I know this is my one life that we are assured of, and I have an obligation to my children. I have an obligation because I have been so fortunate and so privileged to have this life. If I can make it better for other people, that is the basis of humanism. And that's, I believe that. And if you apply that principle, if we all applied that principle, I think what a difference it would make. Instead of dividing, it would unite us. And instead of making life harder, because life is hard sometimes, it does make it better. So I know it sounds a little Pollyanna, as I said, I think there's some nuance to it, but generally that's my vision of humanism.
When we started the conversation, a lot of people kept saying, oh, she has no values. She means me too, because I'm
sure.
You guys have, but we obviously have, everybody has values.
and I would see here in Tennessee, I would see constituents when I would campaign who would benefit from everything we were advocating, benefit from healthcare, benefit from better education, benefit from higher wages. And yet they're voting against us because of exactly what you said, Abdullah, about the tribalism, about I speak the same language as this other person under this one piece. This person I was running against was a wealthy pharmacist who had his children in private school, everything. And then I had these rural farmers whose children were suffering with the opioid epidemic, whose health was declining, whose rural hospital was closing, whose children didn't have the broadband internet. And yet that's the person they identified with because of the power of religion.
Yeah, it makes me so sad to hear that. And, you know, Jonathan Haidt has a book called The Righteous Mind, and he actually studied this exact phenomenon of why is it that people will vote against their own best interest? Like you've seen examples of people that they were against Obamacare because they didn't realize they were the ones that would benefit from it. And it's like, what are you voting? It's like the whole Brexit thing all over again. Like after voting for Brexit, they had to Google what they just voted for. They don't even know people don't even know what they're voting for. They're not educated, right? It's just, oh my God.
Well, and I have heard a response to that concept about they're not voting in their best interest. There were people who would say to me, not everybody, this was the exception, but I occasionally would have a conversation with someone who agreed with me on the points, agreed with me that healthcare was in a mess in our community, that we needed higher paying jobs, that we needed to address the opioid issue. They would agree with me on all those premises. But something, in almost 99% of the time, it was the women's reproductive health issue. The abortion issue, they would say, you're right about all these things, but killing babies or saving babies or however they would turn. And so in their minds, if you were to ask them, why are you not voting in your self-interest? They would say, because I'll sacrifice my own self-interest for the babies, or however language they would use to term that. And so when we say that and we look and we think, how can you vote this way when everything on this side would benefit you? I think that they get in their heads because they've been fed this message and this religious message that some of them even know they're not voting in their best interest, and they do it because God has this power and authority over them, and God has instructed them to do this.
That's
the power of religion.
That's I think you nailed it right there. Like, it's unfortunate though, because, you know, the way things should be is under secularism, if you don't believe in abortion, don't get an abortion. Simple, like problem solved, like don't get an abortion. But if someone else wants one, like, were you to stop them, right? But it's just like, anyways, it's what can we say, right? When someone is guided by dogma, that's just what it is. It's just dogma. You can't argue against that. There's no argument. It's just dogma.
Right.
It's not, there's no reasoning behind it. It's just, it is what it is.
Right? And you can have the most sound, reasonable, logical argument, and it simply doesn't, it makes no difference, because as you said, they built this wall of dogma that they can't penetrate.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Indeed. So again, I do want to say, you know, this has been an amazing conversation, and I want to thank you for your time. For those of you who don't know Gail, do you want to share some of your social media or where people can find you?
Sure. First, I'll highlight Recovering From Religion. Recoveringfromreligion.org is the website. Everything that I described with Recovering From Religion can be found there. You can make a phone call. You can start an internet chat on the little green chat bubble you can see right down there. You can join our online community if you'll ask one of the agents, and that would be wonderful. Our social media is listed there, but it's along with RFR. So RFR.org is our Twitter. You can find us on Facebook, the usual place. My personal stuff, I have a personal Facebook page if you're interested in that, but that's up to you. And I do blog at Happy Healthy Heathen. It's training for, I do some endurance racing. It's country living. It's what it's like to be on the farm. And so you're welcome to look at that if you'd like. There it is, if you're interested. But Recovering From Religion, you can find, there's the kittens. You can find, you can find all of that at our website, recoveringfromreligion.org.
Beautiful. So yeah, you definitely want to promote that, because that's your baby too, right?
That's right.
Recovering From Religion. And those of you who are new here, please do consider subscribing to the channel. Just click below. If you can afford financial support, consider joining the channel. There's a join now button. Your support definitely helps me and keeps the lights running on the channel, helps me to pay for subscriptions and services, and to maybe invest more time into doing this thing. I really love having conversations like I just had with Gail, and your support definitely counts. So thank you so much to everyone who has joined the channel. Thank you to everyone who continues to support me, including Exodus 21V20, who is in the chat as well right now. And as well, John Stopman and everybody else who I'm missing, Dying Atheist, and everyone else who was donated and supported me financially. Thank you so much. Gail, it's been a pleasure. Honestly, you are, you know, you're probably going to blush if I say you are a hero, but what you've done is honestly, it's what we needed. It's at the right time in the right place, you know. People don't, I mean, it's tough to run for office and to put your public image out there like that and to get, you know, slandered and abused. And like, I've gone through like the same thing on a much smaller scale, because when you become an ex-Muslim and when you go out and talk about Islam like this, critically, you tend to get a lot of like abuse as well. But I think what you went through was much worse, and it's not a competition anyways, but like what I'm saying is I empathize with you. I know how tough it is. But like what you did is definitely, you know, calling for, you know, based again, you're calling for helping people, for improving the world based on good values. At the end of the day, atheism is just a lack of belief in gods or goddesses. It's not what we base our lives on. What we base our lives on is in my case, is humanism. Humanism is what guides our daily decisions, our values, our judgments that we make. And this is a great thing. I think that humanism is something that can replace religious morality and improve it, because religious morality is very, you know, it has its flaws, right? And this is why I think we have humanism. So any final words you want to give, any advice to you know, anyone out there that's questioning, or any final words you'd like to add before we go?
Sure. Thank you again for having me, Abdullah. I too have enjoyed this conversation. To anyone listening or anyone who listens in the future, please take a moment to visit recoveringfromreligion.org. It might provide some help that you might need. In addition to that, if you feel like you're far enough along on your journey and you want to turn around and give a hand to someone else, we're always looking for volunteers. As I said, we're a 100% volunteer organization, so you'll be in good company if you choose to volunteer with us. We're also a nonprofit, so all donations go entirely to promoting our programs and our reach, to be able to let people know that they don't have to walk this journey alone. There are people who care. There are people that they can seek help from, and support and guidance and encouragement and friendship. And so I would encourage anybody listening to visit recoveringfromreligion.org. Abdullah, thank you again for having me. It has been an absolute delight and pleasure.
Wonderful. Thank you so much, Gail. Have a good one.
Thank you so much.
Bye, everyone.